Welcome to the Materials Universe podcast, where we will explore the materials world and how it shapes our lives. My name is Bailey Tibbett, and I will be your host this season. Please join me as I interview researchers from the Center for Dynamics and Control of Materials at the University of Texas at Austin.
Hello, everyone. My name is Audrey, and I'm a producer over here at the Materials Universe.
Hello, everyone. My name is Bailey Tibbett. Today, I have with me a very special guest, Dr. Brian Korgol. He was the former director for educational outreach and diversity for our MRSEC Center and is currently the director of the Texas Energy Institute. Please welcome him.
Great. Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation to come talk to y'all.
Yeah, we love to hear from our professors and, of course, anyone who's contributing to kind of disseminating MRSEC's research out into the world. So could you give us an overview of your research? Like, what do you exactly study?
Yeah, well, so my group does nanomaterials chemistry. I'm a chemical engineer by training, so did my undergrad and my PhD in chemical engineering at UCLA, and then did a postdoc in chemistry at University College Dublin in Ireland for about a year and a half, and then came to UT. My career journey has never been something I predicted over a course of time. So I've always liked science. I didn't go into undergrad thinking, oh, I'm going to be a professor, because I honestly didn't know what professors did. My impression was that professors, most of them would just spend their life trying to figure something out and then never figure it out. And I was like, that sounds terrible.
It sounds so depressing.
Yeah, so that's the few people who figure it out, they get a Nobel Prize. But, most of the professors are just never get there. It turns out that is not what a professor's life is like. We're always trying to figure things out, and we always have lots of little discoveries, and it's exciting. I got really interested in research during my grad school. I TA'd a class or two, discovered I kind of like teaching, and then decided to become a professor at that point. So I sort of figured out my values. So my research area is really nanomaterials chemistry. We make colloidal quantum dots. So the topic for the Nobel Prize in chemistry for last year, that's my research area.
That's so cool. Could you explain briefly what a colloidal quantum dot is? I know all of those words individually, but maybe put together, not as well.
Yeah. So we make tiny crystals of silicon that can be as small as 2 nanometers in diameter, which has maybe 200 atoms in it. And so when you're at that size, you induce different properties, so different optical properties, electronic properties for the material. So in the case of silicon is really great for transistors, solar cells, but one thing it's not good at is emitting light, for example. So you don't have lasers or light-emitting diodes that use silicon. But if you make a quantum dot of silicon, you change some of the photophysics and the rules, and silicon can become a pretty bright light emitter. So that's kind of one interesting aspect of quantum dots and what they are. And the colloidal part, that is, a colloid is a dispersion of some solid material in a liquid. Like a dispersion of solid particles in the gas phase would be called an aerosol. Dispersion of particles in a liquid is called a colloid or colloidal solution. So we use these synthetic approaches to make quantum dots where you throw reactants into a solvent and at high temperature with molecules that sort of control the crystallization processes, and you end up with these quantum dots floating around in solution. So that's the colloidal quantum dots.
A colloid is a mixture made up of two substances, with one being microscopic and soluble particles that are dispersed in the second substance, usually a liquid. For example, blood is a colloid. It is made up of blood platelets, the particles, and plasma, the liquid. When we use colloidal to describe quantum dots, we are referencing tiny semiconductor crystals, or the quantum dots, that are either dispersed in a liquid or prepared in a way that makes them easier to disperse in a liquid.
So I know you touched on it a little briefly, but I think in our previous podcast, we were talking to Dr. Elaine Lee, we were talking a little bit about quantum superlattices and talking about kind of silicon's use in electronics as a whole and as a very useful material. But you did mention its one fatal flaw, it sounds like, of its low photo optic properties.
Well, low light emission. Silicon also is a weak light absorber, so it has what's called an indirect band gap.
Band gap, in this context, is used when thinking about energy at the atomic level. Electrons, the tiny particles that make up the outer layer of atoms, move around quite a bit. This movement of electrons is what creates electricity. The band gap is used to refer to the minimum amount of energy it takes to move an electron within an atom from the valence band, the highest layer of the electron cloud, to the conduction band, where electrons can move freely and create an electric current. Materials that have a smaller or even overlapping band gap will conduct electricity better, like metals, for example.
So you have a band gap makes a semiconductor. Semiconductors have band gaps in their energy or electronic structure. And so silicon's an indirect band gap semiconductor, which makes it a really weak light absorber, relatively weak, and also a poor light emitter. So when you make a solar cell out of silicon, you actually have to use fairly thick layers of silicon to make the solar cell absorb all of the light. So there's a whole class of solar cells called thin film solar cells or thin film photovoltaics. And a lot of people ask me, why are they called thin film? Well, it's in comparison to silicon. So because the like cadmium telluride is a common material for a solar cell, and that has a direct band gap and is a much stronger light absorber. So you need a very much thinner layer of cadmium telluride versus silicon, for example. So that's why silicon's a poor light emitter. I don't know if I'd say it's a fatal flaw, but it just means that you can't use silicon. We call it bulk silicon for certain applications. But there are optoelectronic devices where you use silicon. So, I mean, a solar cell really is an optoelectronic device that absorbs light, converts it to electricity. Optical sensors like photodiodes, the things that like your cameras and your cell phone are made of and everything, those sensors are usually made of silicon. So yeah, I wouldn't say it's a fatal flaw, but it is a property that silicon doesn't have. So you have to use different semiconductors to make lasers.
So I think, okay, maybe I was being a little harsh. Fatal flaw.
Don't hate on silicon.
Sorry, it's silicon.
My favorite element on the periodic table.
You are the base of all thin film transistors. I should not have disrespected you so.
Germanium's right under silicon on the periodic table. It also has an indirect band gap and also does not emit light. And that's my second favorite element.
So. Oh, no.
Yeah, okay. Don't diss on silicon or germanium. They're not good light emitters, but they're good. You can make them emit light as quantum dots.
Okay, that's awesome. So I know you kind of touched on it a little bit, but one of the themes for this season of the podcast is kind of talking about how the materials we develop in lab can affect like the different technologies in the world. So I know you kind of mentioned like silicon quantum dots being like really good for solar cells. Are there any other materials that you're really interested to see like impact future technology?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so my group, we do silicon quantum dots, but we also do a bunch of other materials as well. So when you make a quantum dot of mercury telluride, you open the band gap and you actually turn it into a semiconductor and it absorbs infrared light. So you can make photodetectors for infrared light. We're trying to make like IR cameras. So like, you know, cameras that see in the dark and stuff like that out of these quantum dots. We have a project on copper, aluminum, zinc, sulfide quantum dots that absorb really UV light and emit it as blue light. And so we're trying to use those as protective coatings on silicon solar cells. Silicon solar cells get damaged by UV light. So you put a protective like polymer barrier that absorbs the kind of UV, you know, high energy blue light. And so we're developing these quantum dots to absorb that light, but then re-emit it at lower energy and sort of give the photons back to the solar cell to improve the efficiency. So those are like two projects we're working on right now. The first company I started was called InnovaLight, and that was started to so we can do lighting, so make light bulbs out of silicon. So I just told you silicon's a terrible light emitter, so why would you do that? Well, if you make quantum dots and they emit light and silicon's non-toxic and it's biocompatible and all of this. So we were, you know, using silicon for solid-state lighting to do that.
I think there's a beautiful irony that solar cells are sensitive to UV light.
Yeah. I mean, so there's this small part in the spectrum with this UV light where if you could harvest those photons and not damage the solar cell, you can increase the efficiency by 2% or so, 2 or 3%, which sometimes people tell me 2%, that doesn't sound very, very high, but solar cell manufacturers go to great lengths to even increase efficiency by 0.5% or so. So it could be significant if we could do that.
Yeah, 2% definitely, I think to the untrained ear, 2% is like, what is that? But I mean, I guess in perspective, like if people are really kind of pushing just to get 0.5% efficiency even better, then 2% is a lot. That's like four times. times the amount.
Yeah. So typically, you know, for a silicon solar cell, the efficiency might be 24%. And people have spent decades getting it there and eking out the efficiency even more. But that additional 2% on top of like the 24%, so going from like 24% to 26%, you're generating that much more electricity over the lifetime of the solar cells. So these days, people are only a lot of times leaving solar cells like in a utility scale solar farm for like 10 years, even though they're rated for 25 years or so. But anyway, that 2% builds up over time, pretty significantly lowers your cost of electricity from solar.
Not to run on too much of a tangent, but the American Cancer Society has said that every year our risk of dying of cancer gets lowered by 2%. And so,
really?
Yeah. And so 2% is big in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's almost like the solar engineer's version of compound interest.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah, I was going to say something like you're amortizing over 10 years, whatever. You know.
So with the work being, you know, trying to make it 2% more efficient, I know you work with the Center for Solar Powered Future. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the work that you do for them or if it's the similar? Or
Yeah. So I direct this center called the Center for Solar Powered Future, SPF 2050. It's funded through the National Science Foundation through a program called the Industry University Cooperative Research Centers Program, IUCRCs. Even just saying IUCRC trips a lot of people.
I'm impressed that you remembered that after saying it.
I've said it many, many times because I've been directing this center for about 14 years. It's a multi-university center, so UT Austin plus Colorado State, Arizona State, and Texas A&M also are research partners. In there, we get a little bit of money from the National Science Foundation, but the majority of the funding comes from our research partners. So I think we have 19 members right now. So like First Solar is a member. So they're the U.S. manufacturer of cadmium telluride, for example. So we've, you know, worked with these industry partners thinking about research to improve solar cells. To the vision of the center is to reach a future where solar power is enabling us to become carbon neutral by 2050. That's what the 2050 is there for. And so it's been really interesting to see how we can collaborate with industry from a university perspective. So we have, this is all very fundamental research we do in the center, but there's a goal for it to translate really quickly into industry when we get something working. And that's been really exciting to see over time. When I started the center, so put in the letter of intent to NSF, I think in like 2009. And at that time, like solar was not even really a data point in how much like solar energy was used in the power grid. Now, I think in the US, it's like 5% or so of our electricity mix is solar. In ERCOT, in our little grid in Texas, the total power production capacity for solar, I think, is almost 15%. We don't use it all the time, but that's a lot. And it was less than 0.1%. It was basically zero back in 2009. So over the course of the center, I've seen the solar industry grow from where people were talking about, oh, solar will never be cost competitive with natural gas and all of this. And now solar, in a lot of cases, is the cheapest form of electricity.
Yeah, I guess having watched kind of the solar industry go from, it sounds like absolutely nothing, to, you know, kind of a larger piece of the energy puzzle that we have today, are there any trends you see in terms of kind of like merging this academic research with industry prospects like this happening again, or any trends in solar energy in particular?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so like the research in our center has evolved over time. I mean, when we first started, it was really all 100% focused on materials and devices and trying to get to an efficiency and a cost point you needed to for the industry to scale, because solar panels were really too expensive at that time. And so now that the price of solar has just dropped, I mean, kind of beyond anyone's imagination, back at that time, there was like the sunshot goal where everyone talked about, can we ever get to a dollar per peak watt? We're like, wow, that's the sunshot, the moonshot sort of thing. And that's been like smashed like a while ago. And so our research has evolved. Like now we have research that looks at, like, we call it balance of systems. So once you have the solar cell out in the field, there's a certain cost with just producing the electricity beyond the panel. So we look at how to lower those costs and power electronics and installations. And we have projects looking at like weather forecasting on solar farms, because clouds come over and people want to know when the clouds are coming. And we care a lot these days about like land management is a big topic. Thinking about that, there's a topic of agrivoltaics, which is agriculture and photovoltaics. So how do you have a solar farm and still utilize the land for either growing crops or cattle or things like that? And then circularity is a big topic. So it's fairly recent that you have all these solar panels out in the field, and at some point they're going to reach their end of life. Like, what do you do with 450,000 solar panels on one solar farm? So there are new companies that are started that focus on like solar cell recycling. So there's a company called Solar Cycle, which actually has a solar cycling, has a solar cell recycling facility in Odessa, Texas, out in the middle of the Permian Basin, like oil and gas country. And there's a startup doing solar cell recycling. And because there are just also a bunch of solar farms out there.
Yes. So it sounds like solar energy has been kind of like a really big driving force in your research and your career as professor.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of a little bit off topic, but if you weren't to pursue a PhD and weren't to become a professor, do you have any idea of maybe what would be driving your future then? Would it still be solar related, or would it be something
entirely
different?
If I didn't become a professor? One thing I've discovered is that over the course of time is I'm an artist, and I didn't fully appreciate it throughout my life. Like, my parents weren't artists. I wasn't really exposed much to like what an artist does, but I make art now. So I ended up creating a project, bringing artists into the lab. I was at a event, this is maybe 10 years ago now, in Moscow, Russia, where there's a new university, what was new at the time, called Skolkovo Institute of Technology, Skoltech. And they had an event called Ideas Lab, where it was a week long. They brought in like 35 or 40 professors from all over the world in different domains to talk about research that might speed innovation from the university into the private sector. And we came up with this project concept. We called it Rapid Design Pivot. And the idea was to inject artists into the process of innovation, where, say, you have a startup company and you have artists bringing all these like wacky ideas out of left field, all to try to figure out what might work or often what might not work, so you can pivot to different ideas before you run out of money as your startup company. So we ended up getting a grant for that. And then I was working with all of these artists that we brought into the project, and we worked up to our first show. And I was having lunch with a couple of the artists, and I jokingly said, oh, wouldn't it be funny if I made something for the show? And they both were like, yeah, you need to make something. And so ever since then, I was sort of like forced to make something for this show. And I didn't know what I was going to do. It was very stressful for me. I was like, I've never made an art object for an installation, and ended up, you know, creating something in that show and discovered, like, I really enjoyed that process. So now I've had things in, I don't know, 6 installations or something in the last, I don't know, 7 years or something like that. And so there are times, I love my job. I like what I do. I like being a professor. I'm not going to quit. But there are times where I wish I had more time for art, for sure, to make art. And in my current role as Energy Institute Director and all the other stuff I'm doing, I have very limited bandwidth to make art. But I think I'd probably be an artist if I, you know, full-time artist, if I wasn't a professor. I don't know how I'd make money, because it's very difficult for artists to make money and sustain themselves. So I'd probably still have a day job of some sort, even as an artist. That's probably what I would do, though. I'd be making more art if I wasn't a full-time professor.
Before we take advantage of this wonderful segue, there's a famous photo on the MRSEC website of an artist who took being artist in residence pretty literally.
Uh-huh.
And he built a bunk bed above your desk, I believe, and lived there.
Yeah.
For a period of time,
yes,
while you were doing research?
Yeah, it's Daniel Boshkoff. So he was one of the artists I was having lunch with who told me I had to make something for that show. Daniel's he's an artist. He's also a professor at Hunter College in New York. He's a classically trained painter from Sofia, Bulgaria. But his art is not just painting. He's a conceptual artist. He's super funny. One of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. And so we were getting ready for this first show I was talking about. And so we'd have artists coming to UT to try to work with the scientists. And one of the challenges was everyone's so busy. Like, so someone, an artist comes to Austin, they've got to find like an Airbnb somewhere. They're kind of off campus. They're trying to set up meetings with the faculty and the scientists, and it just takes a lot of time. So Daniel kind of came to my office on one of his visits, and he kind of starts asking me, could I like just sleep in one of the grad student offices or something like this? And I'm like, no, I don't think that's a good idea, but you could probably sleep in my office, you know? I mean, it'd be fine. And so I thought, so he seemed interested in that, and I was kind of open to it. I didn't know Daniel very well at that time, so I was like, I don't know how this is going to go. But I imagine him bringing in a little cot, you know, unfolding it in my office, and that's what he'd do. Well, he starts, like, looking around my office. That day, when we discuss this, he goes to the art store, and he made a little mock-up of my art, of my office to scale and this loft. So my office had pretty high ceilings. I've moved offices since then, so I'm in a different building now. But he designed this loft for my office. And so I was on the 6th floor of this building, Norman Hackerman building. You can see the Capitol and you can see the tower from there. It's a really nice view. And he starts talking about building a loft, and I'm like, you're not going to block my view, right? And so he designed this thing where it didn't block the view. It was a single bed, and then he had a little desk up there next to it. So he built himself a little mini office as well, so he had a place to work. And so he knew a couple of people in the art department here. So Jeff Williams, who I don't know if he still does, but he was running the studio art program, the MFA program in art. So Daniel knew Jeff and Jeff's wife, and they're sculptors, and they also know how to do construction. So they could build stuff. And they came in one Sunday afternoon, brought some wood and saws into NHB and fabricated this loft. And it was amazing. And so Daniel lived in my office for about 4 months. He would come for like 2 weeks at a time, 2 or 3 weeks. There's a shower on the ground floor of NHB, this little hidden shower. I don't know if most people even know there's a shower down there, but it was amazing. So it worked out great. We kind of cohabited, you know, my office. He would work up high. We call it like he's on floor 6.5 of NHB. He ended up calling this, it was really an art piece. So I didn't know that much about what artists did. So now that I know what artists do, I see everything from the lens of, oh, this is an art project. You know, his living in my office, he called the Institute for Higher Listening location number 5 or something. So he had done some similar things over the course of his career, but it was incredible. So I learned a lot about like how you could use space together and collaborate really effectively. So I would get in the morning really early. He'd be up there sleeping. And we'd talk for a little bit. And we got in this routine of every morning having breakfast tacos together. And I would teach him something about nano, you know, like what is a quantum dot or something. And then he would teach me something about art. And like, I didn't even realize there's all this art on campus, even in these spaces, that Daniel would be like, you know, that's actually a very famous artist who did that. So I now know a lot about the art on campus, and it was really transformative. So yeah, we've got a few of these photos. I think this one you're talking about, Daniel's like sleeping up on the top of the in the loft, and I'm, you know, down in my desk like working, and it's a very classic photo, I think, at this point.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yeah.
I think it's the Norman Hagerman building that has like that kind of infamous amongst the campus, at least, the infamous canoe sculpture.
Oh, yeah. People will either, I think most people love it. There are people who hate it, though, I think. Or they're like, what? Like, it's a bunch of boats. Like, yeah. Yeah, no. So that's neat.
So I guess now that you've trained kind of your artist eye, mm-hmm. Has it affected any of the ways that you look at research now? I know you talked about kind of bringing artists in to collaborate with like innovative ideas that maybe researchers might be a little pinholed about or may not think of just because we haven't exercised that part of our brain in a long time.
Right.
But is there anything like in specific that you think kind of having this perspective has allowed you to change kind of how you do research?
Yeah, I would say I was pretty transformed over the last 10 years in terms of just my career, how I see what I do, how I see what other people do. I always thought of, you know, if you talk about fundamental research, I always thought, oh, we're doing this blue sky research. It's very fundamental. You know, we're just exploring all these things. And then when I started talking to artists about ideas they might have for like materials we're making or something like that, I realized like we are so penned in, like we're constrained by the grants, and I didn't fully appreciate how much we are. So like if I get a grant from the National Science Foundation for some fundamental research, I can't really deviate all that much from what I said I'm gonna do. And so once you get grants, which you have to because that's what supports your work, it kind of really dictates what you're doing in your lab. And I think I didn't really appreciate how much that was true until I was working with artists injecting like really like out there ideas that most of them you wouldn't do. But I think I started to see my own research more from that creative eye, and then wanting to do things that were really stretching the boundaries. Like in the MRSEC, I mean, I created this artist residency, which I don't know if y'all still, have. There are no other artist residencies, I don't think, in any other MRSECs, right?
Popping in here to confirm that, yes, our artist in residence program is still running. As of the release of this episode, we have recently celebrated the display of work by our most recent resident, Virginia L. Montgomery. Her work hangs in the zero-floor lobby of the Engineering Education and Research Building, and the accompanying video is accessible on the CDCM website.
And so just bringing those ideas. So I think it's really working with artists, making art has really opened up or I've allowed myself to embrace a certain kind of creativity that I had within me, but I wasn't really using, I think, in my work to it's what I would consider full potential.
I think I would say you're like a very perspectived researcher, right? Like you did a postdoc in Ireland, you had the artist work you did in Russia. So it sounds like you've had like not only kind of like an artist perspective about research, but also kind of a global perspective.
Mm, yeah.
And so could you touch a little bit on how that like global perspective has affected your research as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I definitely have a very global international perspective. And it's one of the things I love about being a professor. Like I have friends all over the world, other professors, you know, we're kind of fortunate because we are, you know, first language is English here and science is done in English everywhere. So I can easily talk to people from other countries because they know English and I feel very spoiled, but it makes it easy to have friends all over. When I did my postdoc in Ireland, I'd never been to Europe before. So it was my first time to Europe was flying to Dublin to move there with my wife and two kids who were a year and a half and 3 years old also at the time. It was a major step, you know. So I guess a theme throughout my life is also like risk-taking, like in my career. And it wasn't like I was trying to do a postdoc in Europe. It was just I was a chemical engineer. I wanted to continue to do nanomaterials. And most of the people doing the work I wanted to do were chemists and were doing it around the world. But once I was over there, I was part of a multi-university project. So it involved researchers from Italy and Switzerland and Sweden and the UK. And I saw how you could create this international network of partners collaborating on research. And that kind of model really wasn't being done in the U.S. I grew as a person by living in Ireland outside the United States. There was just so much to learn, like culturally. So when I came back to UT, that sort of transformed my life. And so I've always had international collaborations in my research. I did a sabbatical in Spain. So I lived in Spain for 8 months. After I was here, I lived in France for six weeks during that sabbatical, did part of a sabbatical in China for like a semester. So I've that postdoc experience in Ireland transformed my perspective, kind of in the same way as working with these artists. And you can't go back from something like that. So I've continued to have these international collaborations all over the world, which has been really fun. And I've tried to bring that to the classroom. So we have at UT this program called Faculty-Led Maymesters, Faculty-Led Study Abroad Programs. So I created a class. I took a title sort of based on something Daniel came up with. I call the class Advanced Nanotechnology and Innovation for Beginners in Japan now because it's in Tokyo. But I've taught it 3 times in Barcelona, a couple times in Copenhagen, I think 4 times in Tokyo. And so it's a spring semester class compressed into May, and you, as a faculty member, take UT students over to a country and teach a class over there. And so in that class, I try to kind of merge the 3 things that are the kind of passions in my life, nanotechnology, innovation, kind of business creation, and then a global perspective. So when I do that class, I try to bring in people I know from the country, come talk to the class and expose the students to what it's like to work in an international environment. And then when I was doing a lot of art, I would also fold that in. So that was one of the main reasons I moved the class from, well, Barcelona has also a great design and aesthetic, but Japan, in terms of innovation, how people interact with technology, how technology is developed, is a very unique place in the world. So that's sort of why I teach the class over there. But yeah, my very international perspective to my life. I travel a lot, probably too much. I would say I'm on the road a lot, but it's really exciting to me to think about that. And when I think about my own work also, sometimes I feel like what I'm doing is also kind of a broker for peace between countries, because when you're working with people in different countries, you get to know them, you get to understand their perspectives. And I think that is really important if we want to avoid, you know, war and misunderstandings.
So, and taking all these international experiences that you have while you're on the road, how do you fold them into kind of interacting with your students in the lab and like working with your graduate students?
I try to force my students to also get with the program. So, some are more willing than others. You'd be surprised. Some students really just want to stay in the lab at UT and, you know, just let me get my PhD. Don't bother me with this, like, go to France for 6 weeks and, you know, collaborate with this research group. But I'm always looking for opportunities for my students. So the way I view myself as a PhD advisor is a facilitator. So I'm also doing science sort of through them, you know. I mean, my students are the ones who are in the lab doing things. It's not me. And I have things scientifically I'm really interested in. So I bring that to the lab. But as an advisor, I really think of myself as a facilitator. So trying to help PhD students find unique opportunities that, you know, are part of the things I'm involved in and I'm helping create for them. So whether it's an internship at a company, for example, through SPF 2050 or a national lab, or a collaboration with an international partner, I'm always encouraging them to talk to people, get to know them. If we find some travel money or something, send them abroad to work in a lab for 4 weeks or 6 weeks or something like that. So I try to teach my students, my grad students, that like your network, who you know, getting out of your comfort zone, meeting people is really important for your career. And I'm a super introverted person. A lot of people they're like, what? You seem really extroverted. No, I'm like extremely introverted. You know, but I like what I'm doing. I like, you know, I like working with people to build things and do that. But I'm a very introverted person. And so I've had a challenge, you know, through my life as I was growing, becoming a professor, learning how to talk to random people I don't know. And it's uncomfortable at first and all of that. So I'm always trying to, you know, set up my students to talk to people where maybe it's not so comfortable, but it's good for them.
Yeah. So I guess if you could talk to, you know, the introverted version of yourself that's about to be, you know, an extrovert among introverts, I guess, like, what advice would you give to yourself, like, with taking these risks and challenges? I mean, you mentioned a bunch of the different risks you take in your career. Like, I couldn't imagine moving to Ireland with a kid. I have a cat, and that's already, like, I don't even know how to get her on the plane. Like, that's too much for me. So I guess, what kind of advice do you have for people who are looking to take kind of, like, these risks in their career?
I'm always throwing myself into situations where I feel like a fraud, sort of. I'm like, people look at me like I'm an expert, and I'm like, I really don't know anything about what's going on here. I'm also a beginner. And so I think even when you become an expert in something, if you lose that like beginner's mind sort of perspective, I think it's it limits what you're doing. So I always try to remember that. So when I'm in an uncomfortable situation, or I have things, I think all people probably wrestle with things, but like imposter syndrome is a huge thing for me. And people are like, but you're really successful. I'm like, I know, it makes it 1,000 times worse.
The pressure just builds up.
Yeah. It's, so all of these things, I think that all people sort of feel, and then just being conscious of it and recognizing, look, I know you feel a little bit uncomfortable right now at the moment, but once you get going, you get to know these people and you do this stuff, you always enjoy it.
That's so cool. Well, okay, so thank you for your time and letting us interview you. I think we really look forward to seeing like kind of how your research evolves over time. It sounds like it's still continuing to evolve. And
yeah.
With a different artist perspective, international perspective, like so many kind of this growth mindset. I guess just to wrap us up, as a final question, kind of turning it back to the main theme of the podcast, we talked a little bit about how solar energy, some trends that you see in solar energy, like impacting technology in the future. But I guess now that we've talked about more of like the soft skills of research, do you see any kind of emerging trends in these soft skills also impacting material science in the future?
Well, material science is just such an exciting realm to be in. Like I said, I was initially really focused on just bio. I was really interested in like DNA and all of that. Still am like interested in that. But I gravitated more into the field of materials during my PhD, partly because my advisor walked into the lab one day and said, "Brian, have you heard of quantum dots?" and gave me a project making quantum dots. That's how I really got into materials. But the more I learned about quantum dots, the more I learned about materials throughout my career, it's just been really exciting because, I mean, they're everywhere. One of my favorite classes to teach is on materials. So we have Chemical Engineering 350, which is chemical engineering materials, but it's really introduction to materials to the undergrads. I love teaching that class because, I mean, I'm teaching them things about like crystal structure and you know, what's a semiconductor and stuff like that. But just helping students appreciate how materials interface with their lives. Like, I'm just looking around the studio here at all the different materials that are used in different ways. And so when you start to think about materials in your life, I mean, what can be more exciting than working on that? You know, coming up with fabrics that can charge your cell phone or something, or light up, you can have a little light up display as a t-shirt. Like, those are things that can be made eventually. Like, you have to develop, there's still some technology gaps, but I love working on that stuff. So I think it's this combination of just what can you make, you know, how can you make people's lives better, and then understanding the world around you in this pretty deep way. The more you understand materials, the more you understand the world around you. And that's pretty exciting to me.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the Materials Universe.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
That's all for today's episode of the Materials Universe podcast. Thank you for listening to our interesting conversations with inspiring guests from different fields of science and engineering. We hope you enjoyed learning something new. Please leave us a review and share this podcast with friends. You can follow us on social media at TexasCDCM on Instagram and X. Thank you to the National Science Foundation and the University of Texas at Austin. And an additional thank you to the Late's Audio Studio crew for their help with the production of this podcast.